up all the teachers. Time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. Cause they're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you, this is your first time. We welcome you as well. If you have followed us at all on our Facebook group, the War Report group, you'll know that today is going to be The show is going to be a kickoff for what may be a 3 or 4 part series. And the series is basically a dedication and a tribute to the Common Core and the United Opt-Out Resistors. Basically, this is your show. And what we're doing starting today is to recognize all the hard work and the long hours and everything that you have done in the past, what you're doing today, and what you will be doing tomorrow and going forward. You have really put resistance into this war. The corp side has had its way for decades until you guys came along and said enough is enough, and you organize locally, state level, nationally, and mounted somewhat of a counter attack. They were having their way with us. But I look at what you guys are doing as really putting the resistance into this war. And by doing so, you're denying them a direct shot at total victory sometime in the near future. And that's why I decided to do a 3 or 4 part series in order to really show the appreciation and also for the public, the general public, to become aware of what you guys are doing, its importance, and hopefully that will bring many of the people in the public to our side. Today, we're going to start off with a guest, Dr. Duncan, it's Dr. Deborah Duncan Owens. She wrote a book that has just come out, I think it was January 15th of this year, and the book is called The Origins of the Common Core: How the Free Market Became Public Education Policy. I'm going to bring her in because I want to tell a story once she comes in. Dr. Owens, how are you?
Hello.
And welcome to the War Report.
I'm great. How are you?
I'm excited about you being here and being available to help kick off today's series, and my understanding that you're going to be here for the entire series. That's magnificent.
Thank you.
A few weeks ago,
I'm absolutely ecstatic at this opportunity to talk about something I am absolutely passionate about, and that is our nation's wonderful, world-renowned public school system. And I am just antsy to get started with this series of programs. So thank you.
Let me give you a little bit of Dr. Owen's background. She's Associate Professor of Literary Education at Elmira College. She's a former public school teacher. She focused her research on education policy and, in particular, on the impact of poverty and other social factors on public education. Deb, I know there's a lot more there. Why don't you add to it for people so we get a better idea of your background and what makes you the expert on issue?
Well, I am a nationally board certified teacher in early education. I've spent most of my adult life in Mississippi. I've just recently moved to the beautiful Finger Lakes District of New York. In Mississippi, I worked with some of the lowest performing students in the lowest performing schools in the lowest performing state in the United States. I was honored to be able to work some with the Institute for Racial Reconciliation at the University of Mississippi and was instrumental in passing a law that would ensure that civil rights history was taught in Mississippi. That's a result of having lived and worked in Neshoba County, which, for those who are familiar with the movie Mississippi Burning and the events that took place during Freedom Summer in 1964 and the murders that took place there, that's where I taught for a number of years. And so I'm very passionate about social issues in education. So that's where I began doing my research for this book. It was many years ago. This book was a long time in coming. I started writing about the free market incursion in education and corporatization in education before there was a Common Core. And as my research evolved, it brought me here to the point of expediency last year when I said, I have to write this book. I've got to get this word out. This is not a new phenomenon. It's been a relentless battle to take over and privatize education for a long time.
And that is what led me to title today's show and the series, Common Core Today, Back to the Future. A few people queried me, what are you talking about here? And my response was, for those of us who've been with the show from this very beginning, recall that I did a show where I talked about Edmund Burke. He's famous for the quote of, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. And that's how I came to the name for the show, and it's also the theme of the series. And Deborah, what you do is so fantastic in terms of laying out the historical antecedents to how we got to where we are today, the people, the institutions involved. You call out Democrats, Republicans. It's incredible. So I'm going to start with that idea.
Okay.
How did we get to this point?
Okay. Well, before I answer that question, I was thinking about your efforts and how great they are. And I thought of this metaphor. Because one of the things I've noticed over the past year or so, or a little bit longer actually, there are many people who are angry about the Common Core. So I want everybody to visualize a hand. So there are people who hold out your fingers. Some people are against the Common Core state standards for whatever reason, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, or liberals. There are people who are, many people who are against the massive testing movement. A lot of people are anti the charter school movement. A lot of people are angry about value-added models and beating up on teachers. So there are five fingers. So close those fingers, and what do you have? You have a fist. And what we need is to bring together all these disparate groups and form an ironclad fist to fight the movement to corporatize public education, because that's the one thing I think we all have in common. We can argue about the Common Core. We can argue about charters. We can argue about data mining. We can argue about teacher accountability using VAM models. But if we defeat the corporate incursion in public education, then we're going to defeat all of these things together. And then the second thing I wanted to say is I had an idea. I have an extra copy of my book. And I'd love to put it in the hands of someone who would value the book and would share the message. And so I'm going to make this offer, and I will let you folks decide on your end who gets it. But one of the callers, I would be happy to send a copy of my book to them. So if you'll provide the address to the appropriate people. Now, the tough job is I'm going to leave it up to you guys. So I can't choose anyone. Now, I've already given a book to my post office lady. I think my husband wants to give a book to the lady who cuts his hair, and I've given a copy to some other folks. But this one I'm reserving for a listener on the radio broadcast. And having said that, let me just start with this. I think for me, I started the book by talking about a nation at risk. Now, that's an old story for many people, but what the truth is that a nation at risk, this document that was widely dispersed across the United States and made headlines in 1983, basically what represents the shot that was heard around the world. It was a declaration of war on public education. That's not the beginning of this movement, but it certainly was the one thing that put us on this path. And I started doing research into a nation at risk because I wanted to know, why is it that this document could have the impact that it did? Why did it take hold? Why did it become the zeitgeist of this nation that all of our public schools are failures? And so, as I was doing the research, I became angrier and angrier because what I started looking at were the people who originated the document, the National Commission on Excellence in Education. And it was very informative to listen, to read about to hear interviews that they were giving later, because I was wondering, why in the world would you say something like this? And I'm just going to read one sentence from A Nation at Risk that has been repeated over and over and over again over the decades. And it's this: if an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might well have viewed it as an act of war. Now, I remember hearing that in 1983 and thinking, that's ridiculous. Nobody would believe that. That doesn't even make sense. And so I started to read some of the interviews that later came with the folks who wrote the thing, and indeed, they did intend to use this kind of incendiary language. Albert Key, who was a former governor, said, we intended to use it to start a war. Emerald Crosby said, we were trying to electrify the community. We used terms that were as negative as we could think of, so we used war. Now, there was one teacher who was on the National Commission on Excellence in Education. His name was Jay Summer. And he said this in the interview. He said, it was understood that we have to say things in an alarming kind of way, even to the point, now this is what makes me angry. He said this, even to the point where the statistics may not have been quite correct. And Jay Summer would go on in other interviews and say things like, he made the point, we were talking about inner city schools. We deliberately left out the schools that were successes, and that was deliberate. So it was a lie. It was a lie to the American public, and it's a lie that permeates all discussions of education policy by education reformers today. And that makes me angry, and I hope it makes everyone else angry. It created a zeitgeist. And a couple of things were never made public to Americans. One was that they were really only examining high schools. They were not examining all of the schools in the United States in their final report. And the other thing is they only had one set of data that they were even concerned with, and that is the SAT score. So they did not use NAEP data. They didn't use school data. They didn't use data with actual children other than those who were planning to go to college. And so with that, there's a zeitgeist. This is today I say, listen, anytime you're a policymaker or a politician, begin any kind of discussion about education reform by referring to a nation at risk, I think everyone should get a rotten tomato and throw it at their head, because they're uninformed and they haven't done enough research into a nation at risk to realize that it was basically a set of convenient statistics to further the privatization of public education.
Deborah, let me add also that it was revealed shortly after it was published and those people that you mentioned got on the circuit and started talking, that they deliberately use a CIA document for its format on how to alarm people in the most effective way. And so they wrote The Nation at Risk upon this model of how to basically use propaganda to get over a point.
Yes.
To
create a crisis.
Create a crisis, and et cetera. That was a deliberate decision. The first pass, it was too placid. And they decided, this is not strong enough. This is not going to get it. What can we do? And it was decided that there was this platform that the CIA had developed, that it was perfect for the purposes that they wanted to achieve. So hence...
Well, that's chilling. Yes, that's chilling.
You have a Nation at Risk is a basically a CIA covert propaganda instrument to provoke fear, manufactured crisis, and set the stage for the incursion of solutions that would, quote, solve the problem.
Yes, yes. Well, that's chilling, and that should get everyone's attention. Is that really the path you want in education and any issues of reform? Unbelievable. You know, and at the same time, I have to say, Jonathan Kozol, the great Jonathan Kozol, was bringing all of these issues, the issues of the inner city schools and urban areas and children, you know, who are attending schools in districts that had been absolutely robbed of their financial wherewithal to even educate children due to white flight and pervasive poverty. But nobody listened. The only people that really paid attention to Jonathan Kozol were those of us who were deeply concerned about issues of social justice. And Washington didn't listen. Policymakers didn't listen. They were so busy. As you said, they were fomenting fear and an aura of crisis in our country to get what they wanted. And that was the privatization of public education. The people behind A Nation at Risk, and that's what we'll talk about in a minute, is the wellspring of the Reagan ascendancy to presidency, his conservative allies, his gurus, the people he lauded as having the great minds in this country, were people who were deeply entrenched in anti-public school sentiment and elitists. And so, yeah, that it doesn't really surprise me. It is alarming, but it doesn't surprise me. You know, what's interesting is that...
Let's go, yes. Deborah, let's go to the very beginning of your book where you make the statement that I use basically for the title of the show, that Common Core Today, Back to the Future. Let's go back to the future of the 1930s. Where do you start your analysis?
Okay. That was a really disarming part of my research over the years, is because in thinking about A Nation at Risk, now Common Core, backtracking it, looking at A Nation at Risk, I found that what I needed to do was to truly get into the mind of the conservative. I had to figure out, now, what is the wellspring of the Common Core state standards in our current era of education reform? And so in doing that, it was fascinating because for me, it felt like I was deciphering the Rosetta Stone. I had to learn the language of the conservative. I felt like I already knew the language of the progressive educator, but then I had to get into the mind also of the progressives that were in around before A Nation at Risk. And so in doing that, I had to read quite a few books. And, for example, one that stands out as a hallmark is a book by Albert Nock written in 1931. The book was entitled The Theory of Education in the United States. And here's what's alarming about that book, because it did become a very often quoted book, And Albert Nock is thought of as one of the founding fathers of the conservative movement. And in particular, his ideas about education were lauded among the conservatives, the libertarians and conservatives prior to Reagan. And so one of the things that bothered me about Albert Nock's book is this. He really was against the theory of educational equality. He hated progressive education. He thought it was socialist. He thought it was a perverse popular doctrine that everybody is educable. Now, do you understand what he's saying? He's saying he did not believe that many children were even educable. They could not be educated. And therefore, the progressives were wrong-headed because we really believed, and I say we because I'm a progressive educator, we really believe that all children can learn. He also didn't believe that most people could be truly literate. He said, well, you know, a lot of people can learn to read, but can they be truly literate? Because he felt that education should be based on the great traditions. We can translate that, can't we? The traditions of the white male elite. And that's what he believed. And so, and then following him, I'm just going to name a few of the folks that Reagan considered his wellspring of his conservative ideas. Another one that I read was Russell Kirk's book in 1953, The Conservative Mind. And in this book, and of course, now Russell Kirk was a disciple of Albert J. Nock, and actually communicated with him during the war. And so now the interesting thing about Kirk is, one, he was Reagan's favorite philosopher, so keep that in mind, and was awarded handsomely by the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, Bush won. What Russell Kirk did was he lauded not only Nock's ideas about education, but he lauded Southern conservatism, a particular breed of conservative. And this, his lauding of Southern conservatism emboldened the resistance movement to integration and the Brown decision. And then another one is Frank Schodorov. And Frank Schodorov is important. He started writing about education in the 1940s. Within a week after the Brown decision was handed down in 1954, he published an article called A Solution for Our Public Schools in Human Events. Now, this is important because this particular article suggested that the best way to reform public schools who were in the grips of what he deemed to be a socialist progressive movement was the idea of school vouchers. And he said, if we had school vouchers, we would have no problems. This idea was seized upon by Southern segregationists in Mississippi. In Mississippi, a man named Judge Tom Brady, who was instrumental in starting a massive citizens' council resistance to integration, quoted Frank Schodorov in a document that became a book, in a speech that later became a book called Black Monday. And this particular book was disseminated across the southern states and in some other states as a way to use a school voucher model to avoid desegregating schools. And there were many experiments in that as we went forward. So those three were, came out. There are many others that I discuss in Chapter 2. But I think the final one that that we really need to understand are the ideas of Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman was Ronald Reagan's guru. Milton Friedman is a Nobel Prize-winning economist who devoted the last half of his career to promoting education reform in the form of school vouchers and choice, and founded the Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. And he claims, his organization, he's passed away since, but his organization claims a resounding victory right now because of the massive charter school movement as a reiteration of his ideas about school choice and school vouchers, Ronald Reagan relied heavily on Milton Friedman. When Milton Friedman passed, he was deemed the father of modern education reform because of his ideas about school choice. It's interesting because over the years, I've found Milton Friedman's ideas permeating almost every aspect of corporate education reform. And yet when I talk to teachers, when I talk to my pre-service teachers, when I talk to other people just in general, they've never heard of him. And so that's why in my book, I have an entire chapter devoted to him. Milton Friedman, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and completely wiped out the city and all the public school teachers were fired, Milton Friedman wrote an article that basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is probably the best thing that ever happened to these kids. Because now we can remake the schools in New Orleans in the image of Friedmanomics. Naomi Klein writes a lot about that in her book, Shock Doctrine.
About to say Naomi Klein, but also Duncan has echoed the same sentiments.
Yes, he has.
Not too long ago.
Right.
And anytime there is a potential crisis, that sentiment is reinstated for the public to rehear it again and again. But coming from that period, to me, this was a very, almost everything in your book was crucial to me, but this was really crucial in the sense that the 1930s setting the stage and pretty much going against Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal, when that came about, the conservatives went total ape shit over this. It was socialism, it was communism. That was the catalyst that brought many of the different conservatives together. But they came together and they coalesced around education.
Yes, isn't that fascinating?
Did you find that to be fascinating?
I was captivated. Right. I was absolutely captivated with that, what happened. Yes, Milton Friedman basically won his Nobel Prize after a diatribe against Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal policies that saved families, that saved their homes, that brought them income. You know, one thing that I found out recently, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the first president to actually bring us federal child labor laws. For 100 years, we've been trying to have universal public education for children. It took 100 years later before the industrial community, the corporate leaders, would relinquish children from the factories so that they could all get a public education. So you're absolutely right. The one thing, after this era, Franklin Delano Roosevelt probably did the best thing ever for the conservative movement because he gave them something to be fighting angry over, and that was his New Deal policies. But what happened after that was really, really fascinating because they did coalesce around education policy. It was the one thing they could all agree on. You had the Christian coalition movements with Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority. They're angry about certain things. You have the Southern segregationists who are angry about the board decision. You have the neoliberals who are fighting for the free markets, and they're angry about any kind of federal oversight of business. But what did they do? They all coalesced around this idea of, you know what we all really hate? We really hate progressive education. Let's get behind that. And even though we have disparate viewpoints, we can coalesce, come together, and then what do we have? We have Barry Goldwater running for president, right? And what Barry Goldwater found out were the only people that would vote for him because he was anti-federal involvement in education. They came to get, he said, the only votes he got were the Southerners in the Bible Belt and his own state. And then Nixon ran for office and employed, you know what it is.
The Southern strategy. basket. That's
the Southern strategy.
The birth of the Southern strategy. But let's go back.
Yes.
There's another element, too, here in the 1930s and the 40s. They also hated John Dewey.
Yes.
He
yes.
was a symbol of progressivism. His ideas about progressive education, this drove them mad. So you take Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his progressive ideas, which he wasn't a progressive. He was pushed, forced into becoming a progressive by what he said was to the people, if you want me to do X, Y, and Z,
you make me.
And you do that by getting in the streets by tens of thousands and making me do X, Y, and Z. And so you have that going. Then you have Dewey, who has been preaching for the longest, what we all refer to as progressive education policies and practices. Those two became icons for hate. They became the face of the ideas and practices that, as you just mentioned, all the other different conservative groups could unify around.
And it was around John Dewey.
Right. The third principle was the fear of communism and socialism, which has started to get a foothold here in this country before World War II. So you have those, to me, you have those three phenomena that are driving the conservatives towards coming to a unified front that would then take off in the 40s and into the 50s, like you just mentioned. So in that sense, am I missing something? Is there any more that you would add to it? Because in chapter 2 of the book, in chapter 1, you do a fantastic job in laying out the history, setting the stage to the question, how we got here today.
Right. Yes. Well, I would say you're absolutely right. Those elements brought together the conservative movement and put Ronald Reagan on the path to the White House. And the voices that he heard and the people that he read were absolutely instrumental. One point about Russell Kirk and the reason why, one of the reasons why I think he's so important. On the National Commission for Excellence in Education, the group that created A Nation at Risk, there was one person who was appointed personally by Ronald Reagan, and that person was Annette Kirk. Annette Kirk is the wife of Russell Kirk. And therefore, you can see how this conservative movement became the wellspring of what we have today and Ronald Reagan's stance on education. Now, a little interesting anecdote was that Annette Kirk, one of her sole reasons, although she was put on that on the commission basically to represent families, her essence was to promote one of Reagan's pet projects, or one of his policies that he wanted to push through, and that was school choice and vouchers. When the final report, and you, as you mentioned, it was distilled from a very long document into this one incendiary document that now I know was based on CIA platforms for fomenting anger, fear, create a crisis mentality. But it did not include anything about vouchers. Now, that's interesting, because on the eve of the press release announcing A Nation at Risk, Annette Kirk and a couple of other members of the commission were angry, and they went to Reagan's, to his administrative folks in his office, and they expressed how angry they were that this was not going to be a part of the final document. And so Reagan's administration basically told them, you know what, you're right. So what you should do at the press conference is physically and visibly get up and walk out in protest that vouchers weren't a part of this. Now, Obviously, they decided at the end that they weren't going to walk out. But what President Reagan did was he gave lip service, blah, 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 great report. But here's what I really want. I want prayer in schools, and I want vouchers, and we're going to keep working towards that. So that's an interesting anecdote. Yes, the coalescence is absolutely key in understanding how we got here. Now, here's where the and let me just say a couple more things about Milton Friedman as such a fundamental person in this in the origins of the Common Core. Milton Friedman was so anti-public schools that he advocated throughout his entire life that they shouldn't even be called public schools. They should be called government schools. And he continually referred to education as a monopoly. And I think for everyone, particularly those of us in New York, that should sound very familiar.
Cuomo,
because that's exactly
Andrew
what Governor Cuomo said. Absolutely.
That's exactly
absolutely.
Word for word.
And do you, I mean, and when he said that, I mean, I immediately blogged, Governor Cuomo, a Friedmanomic guru, I mean, a Friedmanomic devotee. I mean, where did he get this language? Obviously, he's part of, or he's bought into this whole free market idea of public education, privatization, open it up to the markets, and that the monopoly is made up of me as a teacher educator now, and now and a former school teacher, and the teacher unions, and all the parents who are sending their kids to public schools, and the school boards. You're a part of a monopoly. What a bunch of hogwash. And right out of Milton Friedman's mouth. And so that's why this important, this book, for me, is important, because it draws back the curtain. It says, we know what you're doing. We know where you got these ideas. We know your ultimate plan to privatize public schools, and don't tell us otherwise. They have been relentless. So you're right. In the 30s, we have this beginning, this coalescence, anti-Dewey, anti the idea that all children can learn, anti the classroom as a democratic space where we all learn not just our reading and writing. We learn that, but we also learn how to talk to each other. We learn how to coexist with people who are very different from us. In the 1930s, I mean, history we just don't remember, but our public schools are where immigrants came and learned to be American and retain their identity and to learn and to talk to other people and to do projects together and to do great things and innovate. That's what our public schools are. And that's what Dewey was promoting. And Dewey was no communist, as they kept trying to label him. I mean, as a matter of fact, he was as critical of the United States collusion with the Soviet Union. He called it a love feast we had with the Soviet Union. He said, it's okay to give them, you know, support in World War II, but for crying out loud, remember who they are. You know, be cautious. But nobody wanted to talk about that. They wanted to label him a socialist, a communist, and all of the red baiting that went on with HUAC and trying to find communists within the ranks of the teachers. I dispel that in the book. I look at primary documents. I look at first reports from teachers. I look at movements to try to label teachers as socialists and communists. And, of course, it was just a bunch of hooey. Their teachers, for the most part, they were just citizens. They were just people earning a living and earning a living by doing the most honorable thing, spending their days with the kids, teaching and trying to help all kids realize the American dream. And you know, as we're speaking about that, I want to point out a couple of things that I think are really important with the nation at risk. There are three documents that are absolutely fundamental because they dispelled a nation at risk conclusions. The first one actually predated a nation at risk by a few years. And this one was produced by the College Entrance Examination Board. And they were looking at the realities. Yes, the SAT scores had gone down in the late 60s and early and 70s. Yes, they had. But they provide an explanation. And that explanation is this. Our country, our wonderful United States of America, was intent on addressing issues of race and inequality and poverty. And we were providing more and more high school students with the opportunity to realize the American dream of going to college. And with more people taking the SAT, it would be nonsensical to think that the scores wouldn't go down for a time. And then another one came out 2 years after A Nation at Risk, and it was written by William Turnbull. He was the former head of the Educational Testing Services College Board. He wrote an article entitled Student Change, Program Change, Why the SAT Scores Kept Falling. And he found basically the same thing. Any drops in the SAT scores at that time were attributable to the kind of students and the number of students who were for the first time ever taking the SAT. This included students of color, students of poverty, and women. Women who had never really thought about going to college before, now in the 60s and 70s, were sitting for the SATs. Of course, the scores would drop for a time. And then, finally, the Sandia Report. The Sandia Report is a very contentious document. It was published during the Bush 1 administration, and the Sandia Report was actually, it was commissioned by the Bush 1 administration, by the Sandia Laboratories. And I think what they thought they were going to get is another big document, a big set of research that would mirror and mimic A Nation at Risk to further promote the idea that our public schools were failing. But lo and behold, these honorable scientists did their research at the Sandia Laboratories, and they published it, and they dispelled almost every item in A Nation at Risk, basically saying the same thing that the other two reports were saying, that our nation's schools are certainly not at risk. We have a lot to be proud of. There are more and more students who are exceeding the generations before them. Our country has wrestled with issues of race, of poverty, of gender inequality, and we keep working on it. And yes, we are spending more money than other countries, but guess why we're spending more money? Because we're providing excellent education for all students, including those with disabilities, and that takes more money. And it takes more money to have special education services. No other country in the world is doing what we're trying to do. Guess what happened to the Sandia Report?
It was buried.
It was buried amid much dispute and anger. The Department of Education under Bush 1 buried it. People would continue for years to say, oh, no, we didn't bury it. We just wanted it to be peer-reviewed. It wasn't acceptable. But the person who headed the Sandia Research, Lee Bray, told the late and great Gerald Bracey in a phone conversation years later, absolutely, yes, they buried it. And the only time it was published was in the Education Research Journal in 1993 in a place sufficiently hidden to most people that could only be accessed by a very specific set of researchers who knew where to look. I can only wonder, James, I can only wonder where we would be now in education reform if the Sandia Report had been published with the same aplomb as A Nation at Risk. If the newspapers had published headlines that said, guess what? We're doing great. We're not at risk. A Nation at Risk was wrong. Our public schools are great. Our teachers are doing admirable work. What would have happened? I don't think we would be here now. I think that we would be having a complete, well, you know what? You might not even be doing your radio program, and I might not have had to write the book. Because
I think you are so correct on that. I've said on the show previously that right after, during the late 40s and into the 50s, there was a sociologist from Sweden who was brought over by the, I think it was the Ford Foundation, to conduct the most comprehensive study of race relations in America. The book,
yes.
The series, two-volume series, was called American Dilemma, Gunther Myrdal.
Gunther Myrdal, that's right.
And
yes,
James Coleman at the University of Chicago, another sociologist, followed later with the Coleman Report. And then there were others that showed what you just said, that it's inequality that is driving all of our social issues.
Yes,
and
yes, absolutely.
And education, when you looked at it scientifically, study after study after study all pointed to the same thing. Discrimination,
yes.
Racism, sexism, classism, the main social variables are so related to education in the form of opportunity. It's a question
yes.
of opportunity. Opportunity will drive achievement. But what has happened, as you know, and you do such a great job in your book, is the conservatives, the corporate elite, they look at achievement as the gold standard, because you can manipulate achievement through your testing, through other assessment measures. And so that as long as you can use the achievement card, you will have, quote, arguments for a nation being at risk. Had
right.
the Sandy document and other documents been widely publicized, yes, you wouldn't have this show. You wouldn't be talking to me today, because you would not have written a book. I would not have started the show a year ago. And the research that I've been doing for decades would never have been needed. Which now
yes,
brings
absolutely.
Us to where we are now. We've only covered basically the first two chapters of the book, the foundation. And this, to me, was the real gold in your book, is the historical picture that you paint for all of us and the details in which you paint this historical picture. It sets up our ability to, one, begin to see dots that we would never have probably seen before, but also to be able to discriminate between the millions of dots out there, to the point where we can start color coding these dots and then start pulling these dots together and arranging them and rearranging them to develop the clearest picture possible about where we are today and answering the question how we got here. So we are just really getting beyond the tip of this iceberg of yours, and the next two shows, and I'm pretty sure now it's going to probably end up being four shows. Hopefully we'll get more into the other chapters with the detail
yes.
that we've been able to get to today for the first two chapters alone.
Yes, and may I interject one thing about going into the next shows? I just want to interject one thing. We've talked about the conservatives on this show. On the next show, we're going to demonstrate and talk about how the Democrats became complicit. And that next show, we'll talk a little bit more in detail about the role of Bill Clinton, the third way of governance, and the deep state of policymaking. I think that's really important for our listeners to hear, because this is no longer, even though the history is embedded and the wellspring is embedded in a conservative movement, this is no longer a history of the conservatives. They do not own this entirely anymore. And we need to get, this is what was so unsettling for me as I'm researching this book. If you asked me a year ago how I vote, I could tell you clearly. I can't tell you that anymore, because the Democrats and the Republicans have found common ground around corporate superstars in the corporate world, and there is a dime on the head of every child in this country. And this is where we need to coalesce our efforts. I'm sorry, I just had to interject that.
No, Deborah, that's beautiful, because at the bottom of my notes, I have here, deep state concept and its importance today. Hillary Clinton must decide she is between a rock and a hard place. Does she come down on the education platform on the side of the corporate Democrats that have paid millions of dollars to put Obama in office and keep him there, and
yes,
corporate Democrats? Or does she come down on the side of teachers, public schools, public education, and teachers' union? That group, the latter group, supported her in her first run for the presidency. She was all giddy about supporting them and et cetera and receiving the support from them. Now, where is she going to come down? The billionaires who will tell her what they told Obama, and I mentioned this not too long ago on the show, Obama, in the first race, he agreed to take government financing, which is, I think, the tune of $250 million.
Yes.
When he was running against the Arizona senator.
Mm-hmm.
The corporate whispered in his ear saying, we will put up all the money you need. Don't go with the government financing. He did. He went with them. He pissed off a lot of people because he had given his word that he would keep it, $250 million. Hillary is going to be in the same situation. Where is she going to come down on? And that's why I wrote the note of the deep state concept, which appears on page 127 or so, I think, 128. And I made sure that we would at least mention it today. But you're right. It's something that when we go into next week, it should get a lot of attention because it has the relevance. It's that here we are today, and we're back to the future idea that I've come up with for the theme of the show. Let me say this, since I had only about 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to reiterate again that this series really came from Deb's book. I was going to do a couple of shows on the Common Core later on, but when I got her book, it said to me, you have to do a series, you have to get her, you have to go through this book, because it is so contemporary, but at the same time, it's so historical in nature that when you can bring those two together, hopefully we'll provide a deeper understanding to the public and to the resistors. That understanding would lead to awareness, would lead to understanding, a deeper understanding. Those two, hopefully, will create emotional awareness and involvement and engagement. All three of those will lead to the public, the education community, taking positive steps towards creating a movement that will do for contemporary politician what people did back in the 30s to push Franklin Delano Roosevelt to create the New Deal, but that pushed Lyndon Johnson to create the Good Society that he did, so that we now are looking at the antecedents. We're learning what was done then. Hopefully it will set the stage for what we need to do today, and that those people that I mentioned at the top of the show who are actually producing serious resistance will come back to the show. And at the end of our series, hopefully, they will be much more informed about what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what we need to do going forward. Also, I'm putting out this. I would love for people to send us questions or issues about what their issues are with the Common Core. I want to create a list of all the issues from the teachers, from the parents, and from the students, administrators, as to what's drives them crazy about the Common Core. And you can send me email. You can go to our Facebook group, the War Report on Public Education group, and list out your issues. You can, there are many ways that you can do this, and all of this will be put on our blog and also on the War Report group on Facebook. And the content of today's show will be summarized and also put there for you, as well as, of course, you know, the archives will be made available hopefully tomorrow. And so with that, Deb, we need to say goodbye. You would like to have a closing 2-second comment?
I do. I want to say thank you to all the resistors out there, the groups. When I was writing my book, you were absolutely instrumental in providing me information about the current state, and I honor you, and I'm so proud to be in your company. Thank you so much.
Ditto for me, and with that, have a good Sunday, folks, and be back here next week.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance. I said, whoa!